All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining the ICAT Task Force call today. We appreciate you taking the time and hope everyone is well. We will go ahead and get started, starting with the official roll call. Cheryl Turney, we know, is going to be absent today. Alex Goss?
Present.
Aaron Meary? Okay. Abby Spears also indicated she would be absent. Alexis Snyder?
I'm here.
Great. Andy Tressot? Not yet. Okay. Anil Jain?
I'm here.
Great. Arian Malik?
Good day.
Deborah Strickland? Not yet. Denise Webb?
Deborah's on the other line. I mean, I could see her on the participant list, but she's not bridged over as yet.
Okay. Thanks. I think I heard Denise and Gus. Gus Tracy? Not yet. Okay. Jackie Monson, you said will be absent, correct?
Yes.
Alrighty. James Pantella?
Yeah, I'm here.
Jim Jurgis? No, she's on. Jocelyn
Yes,
Keegan.
I'm here.
Great. Jocelyn Keegan?
Jocelyn's here, too.
Perfect. Les Leonard? Not yet. Okay. Mary Green?
I'm on, yes. Thanks.
Great. Ram Sriram?
I am here.
Thought we heard him. Great. Rich Landon? No, Rich. Sasha Tamat?
Hello.
Great. Steve Brown? And Tom Mason? Okay. Hopefully the others...
Oh, I'm on, Lauren. This is Tom.
Oh, great, thank you. Okay,
Lauren,
with that...
this is Denise. I might have to hang up and call back in. I have a full signal, but you all are coming across pretty garbled. I don't know if anybody else is noticing that, so it might just be my connection.
I can hear you okay, Denise, but I have noticed a wee bit of a background noise.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to call back in, okay, because people keep dropping, their voices keep dropping off, and it could just be a bad connection.
Okay.
Or I could hang on for a little bit, and if it keeps up, then I'll call back in. I'm going to mute myself right now.
Okay, and if anyone else is having audio troubles or anything like that, please feel free to send a note in the chat to our contractor. With that, I will turn it over to Alex to get us started.
Well, thank you so very much, and happy St. Patty's Day to everyone. Grateful for you all to be here at our second meeting of the Intersection of Clinical and Administrative Data Task Force, or ICAD. We are going to have an action-packed agenda today and hopefully a lot of robust discussion around our workflow examples that will help us set our focus for the work streams that we may need to go down to achieve our end objectives of making recommendations related to the merging of clinical administrative data, its transport structures, rules and protections, with a particular focus around electronic prior authorizations. But to help set some context today and following up with our discussion from the last inaugural meeting, we wanted to cover some of the authorities related to federal advisory committees and ONC. And so what I'm going to do at this point, while we're now convened and officially launched in this call, is to ask Lauren, and Rebecca and Tom, if they would walk us through the next couple of slides to help us bring clarity around the authorities of the Federal Advisory Committees and ONC. If we could advance to the next slide, that would be great. And beyond that one. And I believe, Lauren, please take us away.
Great. So I know on our last call, we just had a couple of questions regarding the respective authorities between the two FACAs that are represented on this task force. So just want to take a few minutes to do that, and then we'll also talk a little bit about the additional authorities around OMC's clinician burden reduction work. So here you have, just as you know, HITECH being established under the 21st Century Cures Act. Also wanted to highlight what's not here on the slide is that the HITECH essentially replaced the previous HIT policy and standards committees that were in place at ONC. So this HITECH represents both the policy and standards with the specific charge of providing recommendations in the areas of policy standards, specifications, and certification criteria for information exchange. CURES also lays out kind of three priority target areas, information exchange, privacy and security, and patient access, recognizing that those are fairly broad topic areas, but always making sure that the committee's activities circle back to one of those target areas. And so clearly that's kind of what leads us to this particular task force today. And then we'll talk a little bit about the intersection between this FACA and that of the NCVHS, as that language is also called out in CURES. So I'll ask Rebecca to walk us through the next slide regarding NCVHS.
Thanks, Lauren. So many of you may be familiar with the committee. It's been around a long time, 70 years this year, and over the decades, it's maintained a really close relationship with HHS and his agencies, working together on major health data policy issues current at any given point in time. And the principle underlying this relationship is that good public policy depends on good information. And you may know Bill Stead, our current chair, has said that NCVHS puts facts into the system. It was charged by Congress with advising HHS on information needs underlying national health policy, and the main areas are health data, statistics, privacy, and data standards. As you probably know, in 1996, the committee's scope shifted rather significantly, serving as a key advisor in the implementation of HIPAA, administrative simplification, and privacy protection provisions of the law. And as you can see on the slide, there's the link to the charter, which goes into greater detail. The committee's recommendations and reports are submitted directly to the HHS secretary, and all of the letters and reports are posted on the website. In the last couple of years, they've been very much focused on standards and privacy. And last, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation oversees the committee. Historically, it's been staffed by the National Center for Health Statistics, NCHS, which used to be housed directly within HHS, but was moved into CDC a few decades ago to uphold NCHS's position as an objective and unbiased federal statistical agency. And that happened well before the additional responsibilities laid out in HIPAA. People always say, why are you in NCHS? You know, historically, that's the reason the center wasn't in CDC when the committee was originally established. And we can go to the next slide. And as Lauren mentioned, CURES calls for coordination between the committee and the national coordinator, you know, looking to the committee for recommendations and comments that can be taken into consideration. And I think this really was the launch pad for this incredible collaboration that's been going on over the last year. It really helps both HITECH and NCVHS in their respective work. I think we can go to Tom, are you next?
Yep, I'm on. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about our clinician burden reduction work and the authorities under CURES. That CURES actually didn't give us any new authorities from an ONC perspective, but asked us to write this report. Actually, the secretary delegated authority to ONC to coordinate the report in collaboration with CMS. So it really focused on developing a goal, strategies, and recommendations with respect to the reduction of regulatory or administrative burdens, and it specifically called out a documentation requirement relating to the use of electronic health records. So it called for broad stakeholder output or interaction and gathering input for this report. And if you could go to the next slide. The goals of the report were to impact specific areas. And if we could go to the next slide, it'll pull that up. Great. Recommendations that should address actions that improve the clinical documentation experience, actions that improve patient care, actions to be taken by the secretary and other entities, other areas as the secretary determines appropriate to reducing the reporting or burden required of healthcare providers. So the report really more so focused on actions that HHS could take through regulatory action to reduce clinician burden. And we worked really closely with CMS and focused on areas that we could impact burden, worked really closely with the CMS Center for Medicare, and made some really landmark changes through the physician fee schedule to help reduce burden. But just wanted to make sure I was clear that there weren't any new authorities per se that the this provision within CURES granted ONC. It was more of a request from Congress to create this report, that the HHS secretary was asked to create this report with these strategies, recommendations, and goals, that it really still focuses on our current and existing authorities in terms of rulemaking that center around our certification program, U.S. core data for interoperability, our convening authority. And the other key thing to mention is that the report was also exempt from the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So they asked us to reach out directly to the stakeholder groups that were identified in the statute. And it is now transitioning into an action phase. So we're really, at this point, looking at within the recommendations, who's responsible for what, which parties that the recommendations pertain to are able to move forward within their respective authorities. So, you know, from an ONC perspective, from a CMS perspective, from the industry perspective, there are recommendations there that really call for the industry to move forward without us specifically having new authorities or regulations in particular areas over the industry. The usability section is a great example there, where we're not changing our certification program to add new criteria related to usability, but there are recommendations there that we, through our convening authority, could potentially help to pull together stakeholders. But just, I hope that adds a little bit of clarity that this was really a report that Congress asked for through CURES that was meant to leverage our existing regulatory authority in terms of reducing burden. Apologies, I wasn't able to be on the call to have the discussion at our last meeting, but you know, happy to answer any questions or you know, further discussion around that.
Well, thank you, Lauren and Rebecca and Tom, for bringing some clarity around the authorities of the respective federal advisory committees and ONC. I think it's all hands on deck to move us forward, convergence of clinical administrative data, and more especially, I think we're all eager to dive into the prior authorization opportunity because it's ripe for problem solving. Are there any questions that folks have for any of the presenters on the authorities? Okay, well, seeing none, I'd like to propose that we go to the next slide. We're going to be pivoting now on our agenda to talk about landscape analysis. Wanted to go to the next slide and clarify that for the members, we did send out some preliminary information related to a compendium of information related to historical artifacts. We sent that out last week. We'd love for you to take a look at that and let us know if you're missing something in specific that need to make that a full compendium. But as we just talked about in the last call, the separation of clinical and administrative data sets and systems has been leading to a burden. In particular, prior authorization, we've seen it's has a lot of outdated and complex workflows from its original paper-based genesis of technical standards and policy approaches. The one-size-fits-all does not really work in the marketplace, and we've had a variety of usability challenges in the various products offerings. We've had a lack of automation and templates to help us across the different payers and different roles that exist in the marketplace, and the ongoing use of features such as fax, portal, and phone, producing more burden and further complicating patient service delays. In the 13th report to Congress, the NCVHS community pulled together some information is reflected on this slide, and it really helps drive home the point that existing standards are not fully implemented despite a longstanding mandate for the HIPAA transaction sets. And this table has been updated from what was originally posted in the 13th report to Congress to add a more current CAQH index information from 2019. So really what it's showing you here is that prior authorization has a pitiful rate of adoption using the 278 transaction. I don't believe this information has any pharmacy reflected transaction standard usage. I believe the pharmacy information will be included in subsequent CAQH index reports. But we're really looking at the medical side of the house in this chart and showing that, you know, in contrast to where we've achieved a 96% claim submission rate using HIPAA standards, we're barely breaking 15 when it comes to prior authorization. Next slide, please. The landscape of the industry has continued to understand that the prior authorization transaction adopted under HIPAA wasn't meeting our needs and has really come together over a number of years. I mean, we really highlighted the challenges back in the 2015-2016 timeframe with industry's input at a variety of hearings. And so since that time, we've seen industry groups such as the AMA and WEDI and AHIP and CAQH Core take on what can we do to improve prior authorization from a conceptual level of agreements to standards bodies work evolving modern technology solutions such as HL7 Da Vinci Project with creating a clinical conversation around coverage requirements, discovery to the document templates and rules from payers being presented to wrapping up the conversation for prior authorization support in an API FHIR-enabled way that can maintain our HIPAA compliance. Leverages features through CDS hooks and CQL standards. So what we're seeing is that the marketplace of the standards community as well as business best practices are coming together to really help understand the opportunities and to reduce the barriers that we currently have in the prior authorization dynamic. And that will help us learn what opportunities from a broader ecosystem perspective we're going to have as we merge the clinical and administrative data standards and related policies and transport and protections. So as members take a look at the compendium, we ask you to send us any information related to that compendium. If it's short-sighted, we've really pulled far and wide and hope that we have a pretty substantial body of work for your review, and really looking to jump into the next level of conversation, because I think that we've all been involved in prior authorization for quite some time, and I know there are a number of people who are looking to this group to produce the "so what's different this time" in having a prior authorization conversation, So if you have anything on the current landscape, please let us know. We can update that and make that available as appropriate. I'm going to take any questions on the current landscape and the compendium review request before I move on to the next slide.
Hi, Alex. It's Jocelyn.
Hi, Jocelyn.
Couple questions, and I apologize. I've been offline, so I have not read the entire giant file you sent us at the end of last week, but we'll dig in. I noticed that you don't have NCPDP mentioned here. Are we looking at scope of both pharmacy PA and medical PA?
Yeah, we really are, and I think we've realized with EPA under MMA that things are humming along fairly well there. But I don't think it was an intentional omission. It's a good
eye spy
on your part. But I think it was really kind of the landscape, the more of the challenges we've been having in the medical side of the house. And I thank you for calling it out, because we really not only want to tackle medical and pharmacy, but we also want to think about any of the specialty sort of dynamics related to prior authorization as we move forward.
And I think that's the meat of where we're at, is really trying to figure out how do we continue to get throughput with the really great uptake we've seen with scripts. But I also think we're actively talking in work group about how to deal with things that butt up against this very space, and specialty medications definitely are right in the center of it. So I can touch base with you offline and figure out who or what sort of data you think would be helpful to include here. Because I do think having folks understand that we are using a very specific solution with lots of success. So it works, you can get PA to work better, but there's, you know, being able to also understand that there's room for us to unpack and do better.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Other questions? Okay, so let's go on to the next slide, please. I'm going to ask Jim Gieris to jump in with me on this one, if you can go to the next slide. Jim has been really helpful after our last call, and his thoughtful remarks about, you know, really solidifying our work around like the chassis, the body of the car to come later. He offered us some sample workflows, and we're going to walk through those today, and we think that it's really important that we have a shared understanding through a simplified high-level model review so we can organize and drive our work. Some of this is going to feel like a little bit of ground level 101 vanilla flavor, but we figure it's very important to make sure that we build the house correctly and connect and collect the things that we're missing along the way, like unintentionally forgetting NCPDP on the last slide. So I'm going to have Jim walk us through this high-level model today. We want you to think of this as a general prototype that's our base that we can tweak over time to get to medical services, inpatient services, durable medical equipment, and pharmacy-related types of prior authorizations. Our goal today is to review this model and then discuss how it can be leveraged to define and drive our work as we move forward. So we appreciate your patience as we walk through a sample prototype, and then we'll be opening it up for questions. So, Jim, can you verify that you're on audio?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can. That's awesome. So would you like to offer any other opening remarks before we dive into the sample prototype?
I think you did a good job. And the suggestion for the group's consideration was if we were able to focus first on just what are the simplified steps, realizing that, you know, for durable medical equipment versus medical service versus hospital services, that there may be a little bit of tweaking. But if we understood kind of what the steps are together, however simple it may be, then we have a song sheet we're all singing from, and then could go back and say, hey, look, at point A, what are the opportunities through the lens of what these two organizations have authority around, at the bottom in the green, you see around how would we develop, you know, standards.
Jim, hold on a second. Excel, can you advance to the next slide, please? Thank you. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. So in the green at the bottom, the notion is if we look at the workflow and kind of agree on what the different steps are, that we could then dissect it in an organized way and say, what are the opportunities for automation, agreements on standards over content, rules, maybe data fields, et cetera. So what the first slide is about something for the group to perfect. This is sort of a draft suggestion. You know, for example, a provider informs the payer that a treatment or diagnostic test or service is needed.
Hey, before then, so are we missing a step here that is coverage discovery and potentially sharing of procedural codes or other criteria for which PA is required? So at the very minimum,
might have been Arian.
Yeah, that's right. So at the very minimum, we need to know that, you know, the patient is covered by payer B or payer A. And then, that at least needs to be prior to A. And then I would suggest that we also might want to think about a process for discovering from the payer what procedures require PA or may require PA so that you can then do the PA check.
I think you're right on. If we skip to 16 just for a second, do you mind skipping?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping you might be able to get through the sample prototype before we started having that discussion.
That's a good idea. Let me finish it then and talk about slide 15 and 16 and then open it up for discussion, because I think you're on the right track that this is not complete by design, that the work of the group is to make sure we don't miss any steps. So the first might be, for example, what you said, then a provider informs payer treatments needed. A payer informs provider whether a PA is required.
I'm sorry, Jim, which slide do you want to be on at this point? Do you want to be on 14, just so we can make sure to catch up to you? Thank 14. You.
So there's a trigger that a provider informs a payer a service or treatments needed. Payer then informs provider whether there's a PA required and requests information. We'll get to the details of that in a couple slides. Provider then responds to the PA request with all information required. Then the payer responds with a timely decision, and it's either approved, requests more information, or is denied, in which case there's three options. Provider agrees. Provider appeals the denial, which might then go to a peer-to-peer review process that then circles back to, again, probably D, or payer recommends an alternative. For example, in age, an alternative in the inpatient world might be an alternative like observation versus inpatient. In medications, it might be step therapy, or it might be alternative recommendations, et cetera. You kind of get the drift. The notion, if you go to slide 14, and this slide 14 is not meant to be perfect. I think you're exactly right. The group needs to make sure things aren't missing. Go to slide 15, the next slide. The questions that might come up then as we move on to 16 are there missing elements? Are there high-level components like we just discussed that are missing? Can we use the model to together come up with what is an ideal state, right? From the payer perspective, provider, or patient, what are the opportunities at each step in this workflow? And then who are the major actors that should be considered or consulted that currently would be impacted by alterations? How do we represent the work that's already been done so that it's not like we're all starting from scratch? Da Vinci's done some great work. others have. One model, once we get to the ideal state, would be to back in and say, okay, what have other people already worked on that we can leverage and put in the model? And then what is left, and how do we use then that work to define and drive the work streams? And the last slide before we get to the discussion is just go to slide 16. This is an example. This is not meant to be exhaustive at all, but just for example, where you guys were going a minute ago. For example, an opportunity might be pre-agreed upon set of rules to know if prior authorization will be needed based on a set of CPT codes, for example. Maybe there's a scoring mechanism. Between B and C might be an opportunity, might be to a pre-agreed upon set of rules and data requirements for prior auth. Maybe an opportunity is automated payer adjudication process. Or if you go down to number four, provider response timing considerations. For example, with CDS hooks, the notion that a set of data is needed for a prior authorization, we would want to make sure, for example, that the provider had the opportunity to make sure all the data was collected so that we don't inadvertently get a denial that then has to go through a laborious, inefficient process. Automated process to allow for clinical status changes along the way, patient status changes. Number six might be automated response has appropriate level of granularity with the clinical administrative reasons for a denial in order to improve over time documentation or patient care. An automated peer-to-peer process, you know, lots of friction and effort when something is rejected and there's a peer-to-peer. Could there be standards for that more conversational dialogue that could take a lot of frustration, work, and cost out of the system? So these aren't meant to be exhaustive. I think the work of the group would be to say, half of those are wrong, or you've missed a whole bunch of them. And so slide 17, the notion is, you know, if the suggestion was if we use the workflow for the areas of interest, we could use that as a way to ground us into a lexicon of opportunities. And the first step might be, what are we missing on the letters, the A, B, C, D, E, F, G, in the process? Are we missing anything? And then we might go back and say, hey, from the payer's standpoint and provider and patient standpoint, what could we do at each step to either automate, create data standards, data models, workflow integration, transport methods, to just start with the maybe less controversial area of just removing friction for things that information back and forth so that people aren't dealing with five different insurance companies aren't dealing with seven different EMRs, and instead they have standards. And then we can get to the how come you're denying it. And so that's the suggestion. Slide 17 is, you know, maybe a set of starter questions. I think the chairs might want to take the ball back.
One of the things I would love to do is that we've got some great tools, and I can already see Anil's using that by raising his hand. So why don't you kick us off with questions? So if we could ask the task force members to use the raise hand feature, that would be great. And then I will do my best to keep it in honest order. And I think Anil got first, Jocelyn got second. And what I would like to do is, and then Arian, you're third. And so what I would like to do is go back to the prior slide, because I think, and I noticed you, Rich. Okay, so let's get off to the races, folks. Anil?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you. So, Jim, great overview of a sort of, I think, a pretty straightforward template of a process. But one of the questions I have is around the scope of what work we're going to do, and if prior auth is our first use case of how we start to align clinical and administrative data to reduce burden, then I would just simply ask, are we also tasked with reimagining what some of these steps could look like in a world where there's a lot more data flowing? And, you know, if the whole goal of prior authorization is to create some sort of trust and transparency framework for medical necessity, then some of these steps that have historically been multiple transactions may not be needed if we put the right data up front, as opposed to trying to recreate from an informatics point of view every step that we traditionally see, if that makes sense. I'm wondering whether we have the permission, if you will, from our committee to really think through. So if you just take an example of step A here, provider informs payer treatment is needed. Arian already mentioned one, which is, you know, having a data set of what the payer is requiring that even needs a PA. But another one would be that whenever something is, quote, ordered, that the information about the patient that's relevant for that order travels with that order. And therefore, you obviate the need for some of the steps downstream. So just asking the question, what is our scope here? Are we trying to recreate the current workflow in a more data-enabled way, or reimagine what a more efficient process could eventually look like and maybe eliminate multiple steps along the way?
My reaction to that question is that I think we should go for the gusto and try to figure out what it can really look like with more data, more real-time options. So I think we should not limit ourselves to just what the existing process is, or the process steps are.
And this is Tom. I agree, Alex. I think that's a good approach. I think it would be great if we could do both, that we could, you know, think about ways to improve the existing, but also think about ways that we can reimagine and make more efficient with the data that we have and the technology that we have. But I couldn't agree more. I think we really need to, you know, use this team to help reimagine and think about the things that we can do.
Okay, thank you.
Anil, so I believe next we have Jocelyn.
Thanks, Alex. And I agree with everything Anil said, and want to, I think, probably get down and maybe burrow into, I think, the point that Arian was trying to get at, which is, you know, from my experience rolling prior auth solutions, even ones that help you automate in the market out into physician organizations, is that there's a couple realities. And I think that this concept of transparency of information is really critical. So I just want to level set on sort of what current world looks like, right? Today, the quality of the data that's available upstream drives whether or not someone from a physician's office today picks up the phone, goes to a portal, or starts a fax. And so way ahead of sort of this event in workflow, often there's a decision to understand what the patient's benefits are. And once I have to do that using a non-digitized format, I'm pretty much stuck in that lane, right? So I think if we think about this workflow, it really needs to expose sort of what's happening up front. And so some observations that I have from, you know, just being out in the market, working with folks on this is, you know, so the quality of the data is available today. Often it's the providers don't trust the data that they see, so they ignore it and they basically leave some stops further in the solution. Either it's the nurse on their team or it's the pharmacy catching a script to basically catch whether PA is really needed or not, because they basically don't trust what they're seeing. In my experience, providers don't do PA unless it's a single doc shop. It's a nurse or an MA that's doing that, generally signing for the doc based on procedures that they have. And that the really smart practices have created cheat sheets to basically back out of all of the existing rules in their particular market as general rules. But that because we don't have a specific plan ID, and there's so much variability, and even just in the last 10 years in the industry, about how much variability there is at a plan design level, the ability to sort of come up with these sort of rules out of the gate of doing it based on CPT codes or not is really challenging, because the inability to really understand at a plan level what somebody's benefits are, that you have to be really at the patient level to understand at a particular time in the year, during a plan year, and that particular patient's benefits, what that patient's benefits are at a given point in time, really drive whether or not something would be covered or not covered or pushed to something else on formulary. is that that's really what keeps that administrative or nursing staff really in the role of doing that, and that each of these steps has a repeat because the primary care doc is doing this work, and then they're handing a patient off to a specialist, and people are literally checking PA coverage and PA rules and submitting for PAs the first time somebody makes an appointment, before somebody shows up for the appointment, the morning of a procedure. And so I think that the simplicity of the picture belies the complexity of the burden, because it's, you know, it's everyone is double checking, because generally if you don't get off right or you trust the old off, it becomes a big P&L cost to the provider organization. And even when people have put things like gold carding in place, it's a trust issue, right? That person that's responsible for getting the off done at a doctor's office doesn't want to be the reason that a $50,000 procedure gets written off, right? And so this upfront, and I'm a little bit of a soliloquy here today, so I apologize. This upfront idea of data and transparency and trusted information that matches the current patient that's in front of you, I think is got to be the thing that we unlock before we talk about sort of how we automate it, if that makes sense.
So, Jocelyn, when you talk about unlocking it, so the trust of the data, the and of the rules, the transparency around the rules, what do you mean we need to unlock that first?
So I think that there's a lot of capabilities in the existing standards to get the information, and payers and PBMs do that to varying degrees of success. But there are so many places that data can degrade in how it's stored and shared. So moving to real-time API access back to the payer or to the PBM as a source of truth, like the work we're doing with real-time benefit check, is critically important. And the work we're doing with coverage requirements discovery in DaVinci becomes important because it gets to that state that I think that was being discussed earlier of really being able to say, I know for this particular patient what is required today, so you can actually impact the change to say, I'm going to choose this option because it's part of their benefit package and completely avoid the need to do a prior authorization. Whereas today, the concept of what's paid for by somebody's insurer is completely separated from what actually happens while they're sitting in their physician's office talking to the physician, because this other set of the team is actually doing all this administrative work. And
okay,
so the ability to bring those two worlds back together is what I mean by unlocking it, is that your benefits are intrinsically tied to your adherence of whatever you and your doctor decide what you need to do.
So really what you're kind of I'm hearing is the fact that we need to have a pre-step, the discovery state, pre the workflow and that gets us at the benefits level on the diagram.
I think that you intrinsically have to understand the patient's benefits, and that it's in the current world we live in, without making radical changes to plan the way plan design works with payers, it has to be patient specific.
Okay. Thank you. Arian, I think you're next. Put your hand down. Oh, or Arian?
That would be the mute button that I needed to push. So I think we've already belabored the coverage discovery and benefit discovery piece of this. I do think it's incredibly important. Secondly, I think we need to put the patient in the diagram. So, understanding that there's PA requirements, if we can't adjudicate the PA requirement in line in the encounter, which should be the norm that we strive for, then we need to make sure that we've got patient access to the PA status with sort of an implied state machine of, you know, where is it in the process. And then, as Anil said, I think there's a bunch of places where we have mechanic steps in this workflow that I think we should replace by processes. So, for example, it would be far more efficient once we discover that there's a PA required for an order that's about to be placed, that when we place the order, we also send off the PA with appropriate patient information to adjudicate the PA response. So there are areas where, I think we're automating a manual process that's inefficient. where instead we should be seeking to design a process that has all the information that's required at each stage of the process. In doing so, we might collapse a whole bunch of steps. And then number three is, I think for each of the major steps, and we should really design around happy path and degenerate path. But around the happy path case, we really should be thinking about what delight looks like and what metrics are associated with delight. And in particular, I think our goal should be that most PA gets adjudicated in line in the encounter. And then we define clear SLAs and clear requirements for any place where we can't adjudicate in line in the encounter. But we should make sure our standards are set up to be able to handle real-time in-line adjudication or near real-time adjudication in the context of the patient encounter.
So if I heard you correctly, you're echoing the CRD, coverage requirements, discovery, Jocelyn's comments around the benefits really need to drive this. Then it was the patient should be added in the diagram and added the aspect of the real-time workflow integration and replacing this sort of the current steps with more automation to enable that to happen, echoing some of Anil's sentiments. And then I think your final major theme was the happy path, which I love. And the metrics that delight to get us to sort of those nuts and bolts of what would utopia look like if we had, with prior authorization.
That's absolutely correct. Yep. Thank you so much.
Hey, I heard,
awesome.
I heard one more thing that I thought was intriguing. You had, just on his topic, you had mentioned a state, Michelle, right, which is really important so that people understand where everything is in the process. I didn't hear that in the summary playback. Can you talk a little bit more about the state machine?
Who are you directing that question to? I think that was Jim.
It was Jim, yeah. He had gone through a bunch of things, and then you summarized it. But one of the intriguing additions, I thought, too, was this notion of an implied state machine that's keeping track of status of the authorization request.
Jim, this is Jocelyn. I think that's a really important point because I think the uncertainty about where the prior auth is in process when it's not done in an automated fashion is part of what causes a lot of the distress in the process and the rework.
This is
so
Jim Pantelis. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Jim.
I can't raise my hand because I can't get this to work on my system. But if I could raise my hand here.
Okay. Okay. So yes, I'll go ahead and then we'll get back in the queue. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll acknowledge that you raised your hand, Jim, and so I think I thank you for everyone's patience. While I just wanted to make sure I heard Arian's all of his great points, and I think that means that Alexis, you're next. Then Jim Jiris, you had your hand up at one point, and then we're to Jim Pantelis.
Hi, this is Alexis. Thank you. I wholeheartedly agree with everything that Jocelyn said. And I really think that, and I'm sorry, whoever was just speaking about interjecting the patient into the prototype here is a giant piece that's missing. And I just want to call attention to back up to the beginning of the prototype, starting with step A, that in the patient and caregiver perspective, that this isn't even step A or step one. Step A or step one for the majority of patients, especially those that deal with this on a regular basis because of complexity, is the provider ordering a medication or ordering a test or ordering a treatment or ordering durable medical equipment and the patient or caregiver trying to obtain it. That's step A. Because it goes back to that piece that we were all just talking about not being aware universally when a PA may be required or not because of the insurance process being so different across all the levels. And when we may not be able to come up with a universal, decision between insurers of when a PA is going to be required or not, because that's a tremendous undertaking for a completely different task force. But there does need to be a streamlined way to make everybody, including the patient, not just the provider, aware from the beginning when a PA may be needed or not. So step A is usually trying to obtain it. Step B is then usually a patient or a caregiver going back to the office and not getting in contact with a provider, but a medical assistant or a nurse or another admin person to explain what's happening and what they need. Then, as Jocelyn stated, most of the time, the docs are not the ones filling these out. They may be the ones signing off on them, but the problem is that sometimes someone who is not trained correctly and or doesn't understand what is actually needed to go in it is filling it correctly the first time and getting a denial right off the bat just for lack of not understanding when it's required and what's required at the time. So there's a whole bunch of steps missing in here. And I think even when you get down the end towards the denial ends in the FGH area, that's not even how it flows realistically for patients either. It's, you know, if you're getting a denial, the patient is the one hearing it from the pharmacist or the another specialty provider or the durable medical supplier. And then again, that the patient is the one burdened in the middle going back to try to get it resolved. So there's a lot of steps in between that need to be streamlined. And a lot of it goes also to the transparency that the patient is not getting during this process. So the process that was just mentioned by Arianne, I believe, about trying to find a streamlined way, not only for patients to be able to see where the PA process, the status of it, it is, so they can get involved quicker. And try to get that streamlined quicker. And just to give you a very minimal example, a patient can go to the pharmacy to get a medication that was, you know, sent over without a PA, find out you need the PA, go back to the office, have them try to put the PA in. And quite often, more often than not, it's a he said, she said battle with the patient or the caregiver stuck in the middle. Of is it the physician's office responsibility to try to fix this? Is it the pharmacist or whatever other PA process we're talking about, durable medical equipment, et cetera? And the patient's getting mixed information from both sides. The pharmacist says, go back to your provider. The provider says, we did what we did. The pharmacist has to do something, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole bunch of burden and pieces missing in here. And I think we need to break it down even more, because we're going to jump over steps that aren't going to improve the process.
So Alexis, to that point, this is Alex. Let me get your thoughts on whether you think that we need to have a prototype by audience member. I one of the things I've been thinking about is the actors in the process, but maybe we need to step back and look at prototypes from the patient, from the clinician, from the payer perspective. What do you think? Would that help?
I think that would be great. And then if there's a way to combine that all at some point to bring it all together. But, I mean, it definitely would make more of a presence to show where the burden is and where all the problems are that need to be resolved going into fixing the overall dilemma, for sure.
Yeah, and I think it probably makes sense to start out with trying to just do the happy path and then try to get down to the alternate paths, because otherwise I think it's going to get a little overwhelming initially in trying to get our arms around all of this. And I see a great little chat going on that, yeah, we could do swim lanes for each actor, certainly as an approach as opposed to separate views. But my concern about starting out with I'm wondering if it wouldn't be beneficial to just take it from a patient and at least the two views, the patient views and the caregiver views versus the clinician and the payer views. But this is something we all get to think about as we move on with further commentary.
They go together because we all need to work together. It's not just the provider's responsibility. It's just not just the patient's responsibility to try to get something resolved. And that's where the conundrum is on how you're talking about the flow and the different actors and the different systems.
So that actually speaks to not having it and doing more of the swim lane approach. So this is some good input. I want to respect that Jim Pantelis is next in the queue, then Rich Landon, then Mary Green.
Okay. I just want to, I'm going to add on to what Alexis already said. My thought on all of this is that the piece that's missing, and Arianne mentioned this, is the patient or the caregiver. And what's missing is that we're not copied on any of this. What we end up doing is getting down to a denial before we even hear about it or see the documentation. And then what ends up happening is that we have to correct what was initially submitted so that it can be submitted again. As someone that has a child that's in a wheelchair and needs a lot of durable medical equipment and is growing, I can tell you that the last time we ordered a wheelchair for her, it took about a year. And by the time we got it, she was almost grown out of it. So there are pieces here that are just missing copying the patient or caregiver, right? That creates complete transparency. I don't know why anybody would submit something for prior authorization and not copy the patient or caregiver. I also don't see a piece in here that says anything about the patient or caregiver's financial obligation and the determination of that in the process. If you get all the way down to the approval and the patient can't pay the copay, then it's kind of silly. And when you're talking about a $14,000 or $20,000 wheelchair or piece of equipment, it can make a big difference. Again, it's just a matter of opening it up and including everybody in the process, which means that all communication should copy the patient and caregiver.
So I think that's a really important point. And also the financial price transparency aspect, I think, is another one that we need to make sure we capture. So thank you for bringing that up. Rich Landon, I believe you're next.
Thanks. Voice check, am I coming through?
You are, Rich.
Okay, thanks. Both on the slides and in the narrative, as we went through them, the terms high level, major, and key were consistent themes. And if we're staying at the very highest level and looking at it as a system, then I think the prototype, A through K is spot on. But it begs the question, what do we need this prototype to do? Because if we're going to use this to test ideas and validate things and talk about workflow, then it is way too high level for all the reasons, the previous four have mentioned. So in order to figure out what the appropriate level for this model is, I think it takes more discussion. Also, add me to the list of people that want to put the patient in here. And I would propose, actually, that we need a system model, which is essentially the sample prototype, elaborated a little bit more and going down a few levels, but not all the way down the rabbit holes. But we also need a workflow model that is essentially the same thing, as I look at it, from what does the patient see? What does the patient's eyes see at each step of the way? And then what are the data flows? What are the data exchanges at each step of that way? Because that's really the pragmatic model of what it takes to actually implement something. And in the middle, there's a whole bunch of questions like, who are we building this model for? Are we building it for large payers who are well integrated and large providers who have the resources to become well integrated? Or are we building it for the smaller entities and organizations whose internal systems this PA process, the workflow, crosses a lot of separate smokestacks and are not well integrated? Some are phone, some are automated, some are through vendors, some are outsourced. So what is the, going back to the basic question then for this prototype, what do we want this prototype to do? And I suspect we will need a high-level system view, and we will need a from-the-bottom patient eyes view to actually get the workflows and the processes understood if we want to use this to validate any of the ideas that this group is going to come up with. But I love the comments. I love the energy. It seems we're all thinking in terms of the same goal. So I'm very pleased with this conversation so far.
Thank you. Helpful input to think about the system versus the workflow models. And I think that when we're trying to build this, I think we're having, from a national perspective, we need to think about including the large, the small, and the in-between to get something that's really going to move the needle, so to speak. That's just my personal opinion. But thank you, Rich, for that input. Mary Green?
Actually, I think most folks mentioned things I was going to mention already, but I just want to put on, I want to support the beneficiary being part of the process. And some of it is because of things that are already mentioned, that sometimes they have to step into the process to reset. But also some health plans apparently also require the beneficiaries to trigger the appeal. And so there's an issue about delays in even appealing something because the beneficiary very often doesn't know what to do, and the providers have to step in, or the providers just offer to help because of the complexity of the problem. So that's one piece that was a surprise to us when we were hearing about some of the challenges that the beneficiaries face, that sometimes they're the ones who actually have to trigger the appeal. I agree completely that I recognize that we might want to look at these processes from the different stakeholders' perspective, but I bet you the solution will be different if we think about the provider and the patient absolutely being a team going through this process, because there won't be as many iterative steps where the beneficiary might not get left out in a number of steps. I also want to mention about the peer-to-peer process. I know that very often the peer-to-peer process is triggered, that discussion is triggered when there's a denial, and it's triggered as part of the appeal process. There are some plans who have that peer-to-peer conversation happen before an appeal, actually. And I recognize that the goal here is to try to get processes adjudicated automatically, so there's very little need for peer-to-peer. But if there is some question about whether the plan truly agrees with the clinician, or there's nuances here that might require more specialty conversation, the right kind of peer conversation, then it would actually speed up the process if that happened before the denial actually occurred, that there was some visibility into the process to trigger that escalation in the conversation before a denial, because the denial just slows everything down. It resets some of the timelines for when the next, when the next step and then the next step actually get to be accomplished.
So thank you, Mary. So what I took away from that was the criticality of looking at the actors' different points of view, but to actually combine the provider and the patient view, because that may give us a different kind of value in assessing this, and that also there could be some creativity applied with peer-to-peer reviews. I'm going to make sure I'm capturing people's key points as we're going along, so if I didn't get that right, please let me know. I'm also noticing that there are folks typing some comments in the chat box, so we'll pull those out later to help us with our thinking, because what I'm imagining will happen is that all the feedback that you're giving us today will be taken, and we'll produce a next version of this prototype to help us further structure our work. And so Jim, I wanted to open it up back to you to see if you had any other thoughts as you've been listening to all of this, as the one that put this sample prototype together.
Yeah, I think I was thinking the same thing, taking the transcript and everybody's ideas and then coming up with the next versions. And what I think I heard is there's the current state, which none of us like, but that we need to map out. And then there's the, if we were to take out a bunch of steps view, the other thing I heard was we probably do need to tease out outpatient versus inpatient versus meds, because there are some nuances around timings and what's automated and what's not that might be helpful. And then the other thing I heard was we need to really take it down another level of detail, that this is too high a level and we're missing too many steps to actually be actionable. And we can work together on the next drafts if you'd like. First of all, is that correct?
It resonated for me. I'm curious to see if others, how they feel about the summation that Jim just offered. And do we have any folks who'd like to roll up their sleeves and either take a particular approach? I feel like we want to. I'd love to get a patient advocate focused individual to help us, Jim, in advancing this prototype to make sure we're getting all of those caregiver and patient sort of perspectives.
That'd be awesome.
I'd be happy to help with that, Jim. This is Jim Pantelis.
The dynamic duo.
And Alex, what I found. Oh, sorry.
No, it's
there are never too many Jims.
So, well, thank you, Jim, and Jim for that. Someone else was going to chime in, and I'm not sure who that was speaking.
Alex, it's Jocelyn. One thing I found helpful as we've gone through different Happy Path scenarios and added additional roles and actors over the years on the MCTDP front is sort of nailing the format of how you want to do that more UML version of the picture is good. And then you can sort of decide whether we're tackling it by type or sort of by complexity. So I think if we can figure out what the next version of Jim's picture looks like, then I think that we can probably separate out to have a few folks do, you know, a couple different of the iterations, right? Are we going to look at DME, pharmacy, pharma med, procedure and services, different paths? Or are we going to look at it as, are there one-time sort of really simple CPT-driven approval denials versus an episodic type of approval versus a recurring approval? Like, I think we have to pick sort of which way we want to look, how we're going to slice it.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about that? Because that's one of the things I've been struggling with. Like, really, I mean, I'd love to get to that level, and I'm not sure if we need to kick the tires a little bit more or if we should and see what naturally falls out or if we should see if folks have an opinion about what kind of view, because it's, you know, clearly we can represent the actors, we can make sure that in swim lanes, we can represent the system workflows, but should we be doing it by a particular view or by a particular flavor of prior auth?
Well, it's Jim Gerges here. I got a thought about, to me, it seems like there's two things. There are some concepts that are going to apply to all four, right? That just, you know, that will apply to any of the four areas. And then there are nuances to the medication, like step therapy for medication, for example. I don't know if that exists when you're in an inpatient looking for inpatient OBS, for example, right? But the notion for both of them that a service is needed and that a set of information is needed is a common theme. So to me, it seems like one way would maybe to break out the four different types, map those out, and then come together and find, you know, what are the common pieces, and then what are the differences between them that we don't want to forget.
I actually really like that because I think there's like steps you have to take. So like there's a common theme of like getting a patient enrolled that cuts across medication and DME and sort of infusion and sometimes services, right? Like PT or behavioral health that are in addition to sort of the PA, and it's a lot of the same data that flows. So I like that idea of what are the common steps and then you're either on or off, right, for that particular type, that it's required or not required.
Thank you. Alexis? And then Gus?
Hi. Yeah, I was gonna agree before Jocelyn had chimed in as well with what Jim was saying about, you know, definitely making a statement for each separate type of prior authorization and kind of seeing where the standard issues are, the standard problems are, to come up with a way to mainstream it across the board. And I just also wanted to add that I think kind of flipping the table and thinking of the outcome of all of this when things don't go right, and where the true burden is, and looking at it from that, and then going back, is really the patient at the end of all of this, receiving a denial and waiting and waiting and waiting, and oftentimes deteriorating, not getting what they need. And I think when you put that focus and you show people what that bottom line is, people then jump to it more to take the steps from the beginning to the end to streamline a process that reduces the work burden for the provider, the burden placed on the patient or the caregiver in the middle to resolve it, and ultimately, you know, fixes the care for the patient who's at the end of the line waiting for something that they need that insurance is blocking.
The one thing, can I make a quick comment? Jim Gerges here. The one area that is a little tweaked on is in the hospital. So many of these we call prior auth as if something can't happen until all this is done. The one arena that is different is the hospital, where a patient's actually admitted through the ER, for example, not electively, and in fact, after the fact, people are trying to get authorization, if you will, because it by definition couldn't be prior. And I think that is a different set of dynamics, because it's really fighting over whether people are going to pay for something or not. That's already
happened.
And I think
it seems to me that that's a really great way to kind of build on this idea of get the basics of what the, you know, build out this prototype for the stuff that we've already identified we've missed, and then get that agreed to, and then and have a happy path, and then start to build that out for the specialty sort of frameworks that we've been discussing, and also all the failure points. Gus?
Gus Taurasi. Thank you, Alex. I think one key issue here is I'm an absolute believer in transparency. However, sometimes the items requested for prior auth are inappropriate, and the physician then has the burden of explaining why they're asking for something that actually is inappropriate for the patient. The assumption that somehow things are being denied for payment by the evil insurance company ignores the fact that a lot of denials are completely appropriate, and that a denial is sometimes damning to the provider because they've basically asked for the wrong thing or trying to do something that is not under current standards of care. And then my second comment is, I think to try and create a general prototype process without dividing it into all of the different nuances of inpatient, outpatient, drug, prior auth, DME, et cetera, has to start with who is your insurance company, because just for one example, given observation, the observation contract by insurer may be very different. Some pay a standard fee for observation, no matter what it's for, and others pay on a adjusted fee-for-service basis for every item done during observation. So the first, and I apologize for my dog. The first question is, you know, matching the patient to the insurer and then following the path that insurer that insurer's criteria are in place. Because, you know, if something requires prior auth, it may require prior auth by one insurer and not another, which is also in the string. So.
Thank you. I think, Jim, cheers.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. Those are great points. I think, you know, the point about the reason for denial. So in the hospital, for example, 62% of denials are overturned for us, right? So there's rich opportunity there to say, wow, couldn't we have a system that made those 62 maybe, or at least some fraction of that, go away? The second piece is, so you're right, 38% don't go away, and maybe they're inappropriate services perhaps, right? But if you look at the figure number six, part of it was, whether it's outpatient medications, whether it's inpatient, getting a granular enough reason for why the denial occurred empowers the provider to have an intelligent conversation with the patient, or to learn and understand what was missed or what was not documented appropriately. So I just want to echo both points. I think we'll either help where denials are inappropriate, or will empower the providers with the information they need to actually explain or change their behavior.
And Jim, if I, this is Gus, if I can just jump in, if you're getting 62% overturned, I hate to say this.
Yes, we are.
Insurance guy, look at what you're submitting to make sure that what you're submitting is rich enough to get approval from the get-go. But that's sorry to interrupt.
It gets back to the timing issue that I mentioned earlier when, for example, information at a certain point in time doesn't have all the information as a denial, and then the information comes later. That's what I meant by the timing
right.
issues are really important when we're automating.
Right.
Because you
right.
can, that's what I meant.
Sure, and it can entirely be a process issue because insurers are under a very tight time frame to get approvals, and the default when insufficient information is given or available is denial.
Yeah, I think that's something for follow-up to the external pressures that we hear pressure sort of insurance companies to prematurely make a denial decision that creates additional burden on the provider. I think there's that should be some research behind this because that's driving behaviors that might be deleterious to our cause.
Yeah, and again, that's a process issue for you guys to figure out with the insurer that's doing that to you or all the insurers that are doing it to you.
It might also be an argument for including patients closer up to the front of the process because an awful lot of the denials that I've seen as a patient and as a caregiver happen because things are left off of the initial application that would have been caught had I seen it.
Thank you, whoever that last presenter or speaker was, but I didn't recognize your voice.
I'm sorry, it's Jim Pantelis.
Yeah, no worries, Jim. I'll learn it soon enough. Lauren, I know that we are officially at the period of public comment period, although we still have hands up. Please indicate how you want to proceed.
Yeah, why don't we take this moment to just transition to the public comment? If we could pull the phone number up, please. And then, operator, if we could open the public line, and we'll see if we have any public comments.
Yes, thank you. If you would like to make a comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up the handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we poll for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Okay. We'll just remind members of the public that during the last 10 minutes or so, in the lower left corner of the Adobe, the public comment phone number will be available. If we get any additional comments, Alex, I will let you know, but I'll turn it back to you for the last 8 minutes or so.
Thanks so very much. Actually, I want to make sure that the Jim, and Gus conversation got wrapped up before I pivot to Mary Green. Gentlemen, did you have anything else you wanted to add on that thread?
Not me.
I'm good.
Okay. So, Mary, it's all yours.
Actually, I was just going to comment on what we were talking about before. So it's essentially been said. I do agree that a certain number of the denials, a portion of the denials, are that the submissions are not complete. And I think that just speaks to what many people have been saying already, is the requirements need to be understood up front early in the process to try to avoid some of that. Because there's no question that it happens. And I was going to mention also that we heard many stories about a beneficiary who just happens to understand the prior authorization process really well, couldn't get herself inserted into the process to find out what was going on or what was actually being submitted. And she herself, when she was able to get inserted into the process, realized that there was some information about her background that was missing from the submission. And she thought, gosh, if she were involved early on, if the submission was transparent, or she might have been able to help. beneficiaries are, you know, it vary on how much, how involved they want to be, of course, but that was pretty telling too, that she might have been able to speed up the process if she were involved. The other question I wanted to have is just going back to the issue about transparency and just mentioning that with a payer and provider conversation, some of that is the provider maybe realizing that their approach might not be the best approach. And I wonder if transparency, even with the beneficiary in the loop there, could help. I don't know how strongly I feel about that one way or the other, but I feel like the patient probably should be considered a partner in all those conversations. And so, you know, everybody's getting smarter and everybody's getting better. But, you know, what's the plan perspective there? Would you be reticent to have that kind of conversation if the beneficiary was part of that, you know, information flow?
Better request back to Gus.
Mary?
What's that?
I wasn't sure who you were asking that question to in general.
Oh,
you were going back to the conversation with Bus, or just...
Sorry. There was somebody speaking. I'm not sure who it was that was speaking to the plan's perspective and how sometimes the conversation is really that the physician might not be doing the right thing, and that was the reason, you know, for the denial. And,
yeah,
and,
that's me, Gus Gerasi.
I'm sorry, Gus. Yeah, thank you.
I've been on both sides of this sad state. So I think that's, you know, again, being a believer in transparency, I think it is necessary for the patient or representative to be involved. But I think we have to, again, be careful about how that occurs and where it occurs, because I believe it should be closer to the front rather than the back. You know, basically kind
mm-hmm.
of the information that's being submitted, to make sure that it is complete, because what I've heard now several times, and I'm horrified by some of the stories, having worked for multiple insurers, I can't believe a wheelchair took a year. But anyway, you know, to make sure, I will tell you in my personal experience, when I've gone to a hearing, which is kind of the last step, you go before an administrative law judge, the times that I have personally overturned a decision was when I learned something new in the administrative law judge hearing, where I was told something that I had never heard up to that point, because sometimes that is the first time that the patient actually gets involved. So I agree with some involvement and again with transparency, but I think we have to tread carefully, because I've had conversations with providers in peer-to-peers where I had to explain to them that they were practicing medicine that was from 30 years ago.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Don't you think that would be important for a patient to know?
Well, that's a whole nother discussion.
but it's part of the, I mean, we're the ones that are paying for the service ultimately, if we pay for insurance. And if we have a provider that's practicing medicine as it was practiced 30 years ago, and that would be deemed significant enough to deny, shouldn't the patient know that? I mean, I don't know why that would be hidden from the patient, and why that wouldn't be malpractice.
I'm not suggesting that it should be hidden. I'm merely suggesting that we have to tread carefully.
Okay.
So I believe we have just about 3 minutes left, and Denise has been very patient with her hand up. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Denise.
I just, you know, was thinking about the comments that Jim and Mary had about the role of the beneficiary or the patient in this whole process. And I just wanted to chime in and say that I really think oftentimes patients are left out on both the payer side and the provider side in terms of how they can be empowered and have a role. And, you know, starting with the payer side, I just know for myself personally, it is really helpful to have information about, really straightforward, transparent information about what does require prior authorization in your benefit plan. and have that easily accessible and actually have the payer engage the beneficiary in a partnership. So I think it'd be really great if we do illustrate the role of the beneficiary / patient in this process.
Thank you. This has been really a great set of conversation today. We have a lot of themes around trust and transparency in the process. We have patients being at the center of all of this with their caregivers and really helping them to be an integral part of a future happy path. And I keep wanting to weave in here metrics that delight because I just think it's a phenomenal phrase. And I think that we have a prototype that needs to evolve and really to have a full reflection of the common pieces that can then be broken down to add any nuances related to specialties. And if we can get those happy paths, common pieces defined, we can then evolve the framework along with the failures that we need to identify and mitigate. But also I'm hearing that there may be a set of general principles about what we expect the new perfect world of prior auth to actually accomplish. So we have our homework cut out for ourselves within the next week or so to produce some additional prototypes. I'm grateful that Jim and Alexis and I think I saw Carolyn volunteer. I think Jocelyn half volunteered or at least offered some NCPDP UML examples that we might be able to leverage. So if I've missed any volunteering, please let me know. If you think I've missed any key themes, certainly let us know. The team will be meeting after this call to think about all the wonderful input that we got today and to create some discussion documents for our next meeting, which will be a week from today. And thank you all for your time. We look forward to seeing you or hearing you on the 24th. That said, I believe we can call the question.
Thank you all. We're adjourned. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.